Okay, very good. So we'll start out with Mark 8, 1 through 13 today. The first 10 verses of this section cover the feeding of the 4,000. So previously we've talked about the feeding of the 5,000, and then so today we'll hit the feeding of the 4,000. And then in verses 11 through 13, we'll do our introduction into the topic of spiritual blindness as it was taking place in the ministry of Jesus at this point in Mark here. So the feeding of the 4,000 is found only in Mark and Matthew. Matthew is our parallel account here. And we would find that in Matthew 15, 32 through 38. And we'll end up referencing that a couple times today. There are so many parallels here between the feeding of the 4,000 and the 5,000. It may seem to us like this is a deja vu all over again situation. And if you read the feeding of the 4,000 pretty quickly, if you're skimming through it, they really sound extremely similar. But sincerely, there are liberal scholars who have made assertion in analyzing these two accounts that the feeding of the 4 and 5,000 are actually something like two different versions of the same exact real-life event. A plain reading of the Gospels makes it clear that they are, in fact, separate events, and we'll detail that throughout the hour this morning. If you have a map from one of the previous Sunday schools where we've talked about the geography of the region and where Jesus and the disciples are at in this stage of the ministry, grab one of those maps, or if you have one, a study map in one of your Bibles, maybe take a moment to grab one of those to get an idea of the path that Jesus and the disciples have followed to get us to this point in Mark. Our setting today is in the region of the Decapolis, and we get that from Mark 7:31, which tells us that. And the time frame we're in now is probably months after the feeding of the 5,000. Prior to coming to the Decapolis, Jesus and the disciples had traveled north to the region of Tyre and Sidon, where they met the Syrophoenician woman. And following that, they traveled south and east all the way down around the east side of the Sea of Galilee to where the Decapolis was located, a region of 10 Gentile cities. These first 10 verses will end up taking us down the home stretch of the ministry of Jesus to the Gentiles. So if someone would read verse 1 for us to get us started, please.
In those days when there was again a large crowd and they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples and said to them.
So this follows the healing of the deaf and mute man at the end of Mark chapter 7, and that apparently had caused a stir in the region. And it would not have been the first time people in this area had heard of Jesus. A couple chapters back in Mark 5, after Jesus healed the demoniac, he sent that man out to be one of his first missionaries. That man's personal desire was actually to follow Jesus as a disciple. But let's read what instead Jesus directed him, what directions he gave him in Mark 5:19 through 20. If someone would read those two verses, please.
And he did not let him, but he said to him, go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you. And when he went away, he began to proclaim in Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled.
Thank you, Randy. Because of this commissioning, people of the area already had familiarity with Jesus, having heard the preaching of the converted demoniac. And it had caused people to marvel at what they had heard. With that background in place, we read that a large Gentile crowd came together. Here, to contrast, those that gathered for the feeding of the 5,000 were a Jewish crowd from the cities of Galilee that had gathered that day. Similarly, these people of the Decapolis were quite hungry as they had nothing to eat. we'll end up comparing and contrasting those two events between the feeding of the 4 and the 5,000 several times today. And so we read that Jesus called his disciples in. And this was another training move by Jesus to bring in the 12 to discuss and lay out the path for what was going to come. Next. Verse 2, please, if someone would read that.
I have compassion for these people, for they have already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat.
So Matthew 15, we'll go back there for a moment. Matthew 15, 29 through 31 includes what had been taking place during these 3 days. So if somebody could read Matthew 15, 29 through 31.
Departing from there, Jesus went along by the Sea of Galilee, and having gone up on the mountain, he was sitting there. And large crowds came to him, bringing with them those who were lame, crippled, blind, mute, and many others. And they laid them down at his feet, and he healed them. So the crowds marveled as they saw the mute speaking, the crippled restored, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel.
Thank you. We can keep in mind these Gentiles didn't have passages like Isaiah 35, verses 5 through 6, that spoke about the eyes of the blind will be opened, the ears of the deaf will be unstopped, the lame will leap like a deer, the tongue of the mute will shout for joy. They didn't have passages like that to point them to a king or a coming kingdom or the millennial kingdom. That was not part of their religious background like the Jews had. But yet we read in verse 31, they glorified the God of Israel. Previously in Mark 6:34, we had studied this phrase, he felt compassion for them. Jesus felt compassion for the people. And we talked about how that verb tense could be rendered, he was gripped with compassion. I had also mentioned how a gentleman named Donald English, in his book, The Message of Mark, The Mystery of Faith, showed us that that verb is used to describe Jesus himself, only to describe Jesus himself, or to explain the actions of people in parables who resemble him. And I didn't have as much time to go through the details of those passages or the examples of those passages back then. So let's take a little bit of time to do that. And I know that there are several here we'll cover. So if we could break them down into four pairs and then have one person do two at a time, to go from top to bottom. We'll cover these examples of Jesus feeling compassion or examples of the compassion in the parables that compared to Jesus. So if the first person could do Matthew 9:36 and 14:14, and then we'll go down two by two from there, please.
Seeing the people, he felt compassion for them because they were distressed and dispirited like sheep without a shepherd. When he went ashore, he saw a large crowd and felt compassion for them and healed their sick.
Then Matthew 15:32 and 18:27.
Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I feel compassion for the people because they have remained with me now for 3 days and have nothing to eat, and I do not want to send them away hungry, for they might faint on the way.
1827.
And the Lord of that slave felt compassion and released him and forgave him the debt.
And our two parable references in Luke, Luke 10:33 and 15:20.
But a Samaritan who was on a journey came up to him, and when he saw him, he felt compassion. 15:20. So he got up and came to his father, but while he was still a long ways off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced him and kissed him.
And then we'll hit those last two, Mark 1:41 and 9:22, please.
Moved with compassion, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, I am willing, be cleansed. Mark 9:22, getting there. It has often thrown him both into the fire and the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us.
So we see how central of a characteristic that was from all of these examples. And thank you so much for looking up all of those. I appreciate that. So a unique item to point out here in this passage is that this is the only occasion where Jesus says in the first person, I feel compassion. And the Matthew 15:32 parallel is the same phrase, I feel compassion. And here the compassion was for their physical needs, the physical needs of the crowd. And prior to the feeding of the 5,000, it was in relationship to the lost, to their lost spiritual condition and the misleading of the teachers of the day. I think this is a real testament to how these people in this Gentile crowd felt about Jesus. They spent 3 days with him in this desolate place. And this wasn't the day trip that we saw in the feeding of the 5,000. These people were presumably sleeping out on the ground in the middle of this remote region in the dry and hot summer season, just so they could be face to face with Jesus, without regard to the length of the trip. The overarching training concept here by Jesus was to prepare the disciples to understand that Gentiles were included in salvation as well, not just the Jews. Such a concept would seem foreign to the disciples, as this crowd was a people outside, this Gentile crowd in front of them, was a people outside of the Abrahamic covenant. And there were so many directives that God had historically given to the Israelites to set them apart religiously, culturally. This walking ministry that had been taking place in the prior months to teach on this new principle was culminating with this gathering. This took me to Romans 9:15. Let's turn there to Romans 9:15, which we also see in Exodus 33:19. And we'll spend a couple moments here to read about attributes of God related to the context of Jesus teaching, introducing, and laying out this principle to the disciples. So Romans 9:15.
Where he says to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion.
Thank you, Ryan. And as Gentiles ourselves, we certainly have a special appreciation for this. Verse 3, if someone could read verse 3, please.
And if I send him away hungry to go to their home, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come from a distance.
We can recall that in Mark 6:36, in our feeding of the 5,000, the disciples said, send them away so they may buy themselves something to eat. Jesus then turned the responsibility back on the disciples by emphatically saying, you give them something to eat. And this account is obviously different in explaining this. These people who had such a deep motivation to be with Jesus were now so famished that if they took their long trips home, they physically would be incapable to do so. The word faint here is an expressive word meaning to become weary or to give out. And it more literally means completely unloosed. So to help describe this, I don't have any visual aids with me, but if we can picture it in our heads, to help describe this, let's for a moment picture a bow, as in a hunting bow, that is both strung tightly and then both unstrung. Strung, a bow would be under and is under significant pressure. And if it were to become unstrung or unloosed, it would immediately collapse back to its unsupported form. And if these people were to embark without eating, they would give out or become completely unloosed, collapsing in the process, is the idea that Jesus is relating here. And some had come from a great distance. To contrast, the area of Galilee was more tightly packed and thickly populated, with many cities in a smaller geographic area. This region of the Decapolis would have been much more spread out with longer distances between the cities. And therefore, people would have, on average, traveled farther than compared to our other account. And so in verse 4, his disciples answer him and say, where will anyone be able to find enough bread here in this desolate place to satisfy these people. We might ask why in the world the disciples could ever consider such a question based on the feeding of the 5,000. Was this going to be another one of those men of little faith moments? I left a couple examples of in Matthew that are Jesus relating to the disciples about men of little faith, and we won't go through each of them today, but I just wanted to leave those for everybody in case you wanted to reference those another time. There are a range of responses from commentators on this passage, so it's hard to say that there's wholehearted agreeance when it comes to this or why they would ask a question in this fashion. Liberal scholars, like I talked about earlier, they'll use this response to defend their one feeding event hypothesis, that these two separate events were actually one. They were giving different details of one central event. Other commentators will go so far to describe the stupidity of the disciples as an explanation. However, and I appreciate this take on this, that others explain that this is really not the same sort of questioning as with the feeding of the 5,000. At that time, the disciples were asking about things such as, should we go and spend 200 denarii? And after acquiring the 5 loaves and 2 fish, but what are these for so many people, as John 6:9 tells us? Our gospel accounts certainly don't hide the lack of understanding and spiritual dullness of the disciples, but this is a bit of a different question, more about scarcity of food in a wilderness region. I enjoyed reading what a gentleman by the name of Joseph Addison Alexander had to say about this in his book, The Gospel According to Mark. Even those who now reject the statement as incredible would probably have done the same if similarly situated. Taking it a step further, D. Edmund Hebert comments that to review the reply simply as an expression of hopelessness seems to misread the situation. The idea here is that having grown in faith in Jesus, the disciples are submitting to Jesus. They're admitting their own powerlessness and trusting him by putting the situation in his hands, knowing that he will provide. MacArthur takes a similar view, believing this is more of a rhetorical question because no one could surely possibly have forgotten the previous feeding. It was more of a question prompting Jesus, not doubting his power, but instead asking about his purpose. Not what are you going to do, but are you going to do it for these people, the Gentiles that the Jews so categorically disregarded. This walking ministry is continuing to work itself out. Verse 5. And he was asking them, how many loaves do you have? And they said 7. As previously discussed, these barley loaves were not what we would think of as a modern loaf of bread, but more like a flat cake or a biscuit shape. Having the disciples state this simple fact out loud lends credence to the miracle about to come that would feed thousands and thousands of people. It also shows us how Jesus intended to involve the disciples in the miracle by supplying the loaves. Matthew 15:34 includes that they had a few small fish as well, which we see in verse 7 of our text today. So if someone could read verses 6 and 7 next, that would be great.
And he directed the multitude to sit down on the ground, and taking the 7 loaves, he gave thanks and broke them and started giving them to his disciples to serve them. And they served them to the multitude. They also had a few small fish, and after he had blessed them, he ordered them to be served as well.
Thank you, Leo. So back in Mark 6:39, we had previously discussed the green grass that was present at the time of the Passover back in the spring. Again, by now, months had passed, and that green grass was gone, and the hills were probably brown and bare by now. Jesus, like previous, commanded them to sit down on the ground, which meant to recline. We discussed in detail the organized seating arrangement made prior to the feeding of the 5,000. And while we are not told it specifically here, it stands to reason a similar arrangement probably took place. The next steps given in the verse very closely follow that prior process as well, including in the middle of verse 6 there, about the middle of verse 6, where we read that phrase, kept giving. And so that phrase, kept giving, is in an imperfect tense, which means kept on giving. So Jesus kept on giving over and over again to the disciples who dispensed it to the crowd. All right, verse 8. If someone would read verse 8, please.
And they ate and were satisfied, and they picked up 7 large baskets full of what was left over of the broken pieces.
So this can take us back to verse 4 for a moment, where the disciples use the term satisfied. The process of Jesus miraculously creating this meal was not getting people just enough to scrape by and make it back, to just barely keep them from collapsing. There was an abundance of food to satisfy them, to the point they were so full they desired to eat no longer. What was left over may have even been for the travelers' trip home. Mark 8:14 will end up telling us that the disciples clearly did not take it with them, as we read there that they were going across, back across the Sea of Galilee, and they had forgotten to take bread and did not have more than 1 loaf in the boat with them. So it clearly did not go with the disciples. So this amount miraculously produced by Jesus was sufficient and then some, which would be a similarity to the feeding of the 5,000 as well. So we can take a minute to note that these are 7 large baskets, unlike the baskets of the feeding of the 5,000. If you recall, those baskets were the Greek term kophanoi, which was a small wicker basket used by the Jews when traveling to carry their own goods so that they did not have to eat Gentile food. These were wicker-made baskets as well, but they were intended to carry a much larger supply. A Greek vocabulary text cites that as many as 50 loaves would have fit in one of these larger baskets. And presumably the disciples borrowed them from the crowd members to carry out their tasks that day. We actually have a reference to this very same term in Acts 9:25, speaking of Paul, where it says, "But his disciples took him by night and let him down through the wall, lowering him in a large basket." Same term here as there in Acts 9:25. So clearly the largest of these was sizable enough for an adult man to fit in. And then verse 9, "Now about 4,000 were there, and he sent them away." So again, this is specifically meant to indicate 4,000 men, like at the end of the feeding of the 5,000, it said 5,000 men, and this is men and men only is the term there. And Matthew again states, besides women and children in the parallel account, just like he did at the end of the feeding of the 5,000. So here it's 4,000 men plus women plus children. That is certain. Picking up 7 of the larger baskets might have cumulatively been a lot more food even than the 12 smaller baskets, if that suggests anything about the number of people that were present that day. The largest estimate that I read when going through this material was about 16,000. So in sending them away, we find a totally different circumstance than those hurried actions that followed the feeding of the 5,000, when the Jewish crowd desired to sweep up Jesus, make him their king, and take down Rome. In those moments, Jesus had to both get rid of the crowd, and then he also had to send off the disciples in their boat. We simply don't get to know much about this crowd's reaction. Another plain difference between the two accounts. Verse 10, please.
And immediately he entered the boat with his disciples and came to the district of... Yes.
Nate, I put you in a bad position there. So this begs the question that if Jesus and the disciples had made this trek all the way down from Tyre and Sidon, across that area north and then east down the coast of the Sea of Galilee, how did they have access to their boat? I listen to Tom Pennington pretty regularly. He's the lead pastor from Countryside Bible Church in Southlake, Texas, and I really enjoy him, and he will use this term called sanctified imagination occasionally, and I think this would be an instance where we would use our sanctified imagination about these real life events that happened in real time, and they're not like absolutely critical to the story, and they're certainly not a salvation issue or anything of that nature, but in real life, in real time, when we kind of put this picture or this movie in our heads, how did these things all play out in real life? So perhaps a little bit of sanctified imagination here. D. Edmund Hebert's commentary will state that this was apparently the same boat they had been using all along, and he suggested that it was pretty possible that some friends from Capernaum perhaps brought that boat over to them simply when they heard Jesus was in the region. So we also read that Jesus was, he entered the boat with his disciples, he was in the boat with them. So clearly they were all together this time, which again would be very different from the feeding of the 5,000 and the events that led up to Jesus walking on the water. This is the only mention of Dalmanutha in the New Testament. Matthew's parallel says they came to the region of Magadan, which was southwest of Capernaum on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. So we can expect that it was in that area, in the area of Capernaum. And here, wrapping up verse 10, this ends the Gentile ministry of Jesus. To take a moment to point out a side note about meals and ministries, this was something new that I learned this time, and there may be people who are already familiar and aware of this, but I wanted to share something new that I learned this time, that near the end of the, that following the feeding of the 5,000, that the feeding of the 5,000 came near, that meal came near the end of Jesus' Galilean ministry. And we've discussed in detail today how he ended his ministry to the Gentiles with the feeding of the 4,000. And then also Jesus ended his Jerusalem ministry with a meal along with his disciples in the upper room. So there was a pattern there, it seems like. And so if we ever needed any more support or energy for more church potlucks, I think we can use that as a very good example to reference. It's obviously, it's biblical. So this is a little bit of a break point between the first section and the second section of today. And so any questions, comments about feeding of the 5,000 or 4,000 or 5, I guess, anything there, or comparing them or what was taking place with the Gentiles now rather than in comparison to the Jews? Okay, good deal. So next we'll move to verse 11. And if someone would read that, please.
The Pharisees came out and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him.
This wording just kind of sounds aggressive when I read it. It sounds aggressive to me. They came out, they began to argue, seeking from him, testing him. And after being absent from the territory for some time, the Pharisees discover Jesus has returned, and they come out to confront him. Matthew 16, 1 through 4, let's turn there. That's the parallel account of this passage, and it's more detailed than this section of Mark. So if someone could read Matthew 16, 1 through 4, please.
The Pharisees and Sadducees came up, and testing Jesus, they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. But he replied to them, "When it is evening, you say, 'It will be fair weather, for the sky is red,' and in the morning, 'There will be a storm today, for the sky is red and threatening.' Do you know how to discern the appearance of the sky, but cannot discern the signs of the times? An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and a sign will not be given to it, except the sign of Jonah. And he left them and went away.
Thank you. As we just read, it includes Sadducees were also present, with Jesus ultimately pointing out that despite their ability to predict the weather by a relatively primitive process, they had no ability to discern what was going on literally right in front of them. And so they began to argue with him. And the word "began" here shows us clearly their initiation of the confrontation. And then to argue or to question means to seek together or to investigate. So they had come out intentionally to investigate Jesus and to challenge him. There was a Jewish superstition of the time that God could do heavenly miracles and demons could only do earthly miracles. Like, think magicians in Pharaoh's court. The vast number of miracles Jesus had performed on earth were not enough for these men. So they asked for a sign from heaven, the dwelling place of God. Perhaps a more legitimate sign or miracle in their thought process. It is interesting to know the mismatch between this wording and then what we also read in John 3:2, where Nicodemus tells Jesus, "We know you have come from God as a teacher, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him." So here in Mark 8, their intention was to test Jesus and to try to catch him in a difficult spot, like they had tried to trap him many other times. If he failed here or refused to perform, it would serve to discredit him in the eyes of the people. Amongst the Jews, there was an expectation that the Messiah would indeed perform celestial signs. And Jesus pointed to these Old Testament prophecies in Matthew 24. So let's turn to Matthew 24 and verses 29 through 31. We'll read about Jesus teaching about the Old Testament signs of the prophecies that the Messiah would, that he, the Messiah, would come to perform someday.
"But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give it its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken, and then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and he will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other."
Thank you, Brian. And of course, we still, on our timeline, we still look forward to that today. But the recognition of that, those coming events, was that was looked forward to and has been for thousands of years. Now, so there are several Old Testament references. There are five different books that reference these celestial signs, and it comes from Isaiah, Ezekiel, Joel, Amos, and Zephaniah as well. And so there are many, many examples of that from the Old Testament. And I don't think I included these in the notes, but I think we have enough time. Let's go ahead and read a couple of them today. I have three of them from Isaiah, so let's go to Isaiah for a minute, and then I'll go to Isaiah 2. If someone could find Isaiah 13:10.
"The stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises, and the moon will not shed its light."
And then we also have Isaiah 24:23. I'll grab that one. "The moon will be dismayed, the sun ashamed, for the Lord Almighty will reign on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem and before its elders with great glory." And then let's do Isaiah 34:4 next. And if someone would grab Ezekiel 32:7. We'll use those as our Old Testament examples today. So Isaiah 34:4.
And all the host of heaven will wear away, and the sky will be rolled up like a scroll, and all their hosts will also wither away as a leaf withers from the vine, or as one withers from the fig tree.
And then Ezekiel 32:7.
When I extinguish you, I will cover the heavens and darken their stars. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon will not give its light.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for looking those up. I appreciate that. So that's what Jesus was teaching and pointing out to them in Matthew 24:29 about our eventual day of the Lord that still is yet to come for us. So back to Mark 8. However, even if Jesus had given the sign from heaven that they actually requested from him, it still would not have been enough for them, because sadly they were subject to spiritual blindness. Just earlier, we referenced how the Gospels don't hide the lack of understanding or spiritual dullness of the disciples. But there was a difference between that and the spiritually blind state of these Jewish leaders. Externally, they attempted to make themselves without excuse. But without a genuine heart change, there was nothing the Pharisees or Sadducees could do to convince or persuade themselves about Jesus and his divine nature and his authority. They needed spiritual cleansing by way of faith, like we all do, in order to come to Christ. But without accepting Jesus for who he is, there was no faith in him. And furthermore, Jesus was not going to tolerate their rejection of him any longer, as we see in verse 12. And sighing deeply in his spirit, he said, "Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation." In sighing deeply there, this is the only New Testament reference we have to such a deep emotional reaction of Jesus. This intensive form has a literal meaning of groaned upwardly, such that it came up from deep within the inner being of Jesus. He had been through enough with these Jewish leaders, and it evoked a unique response from our compassionate and merciful Savior. This obstinate spiritual blindness was enough to do so. Jesus asks the question, "Why does this generation seek a sign?" Implying, what grounds do you have? Or with what right do you seek this sign? Where is the justification for what you request? There had been repetitive, deliberate rejection of Jesus by these people. And because of that, there were no grounds for demanding such a sign. Decidedly and firmly, Jesus declares, no sign will be given to this generation, a total rejection of their demand. The Greek construction of that phrase can be read, if I give a sign to this generation, may I die. He was not going to give them what they asked for. And as we read in Matthew 16:4, a sign will not be given to it except the sign of Jonah. Knowing that, we can turn to Matthew 12:38-42, where Jesus points to the ultimate sign of his identity as the Son of God and Messiah, the resurrection. So Matthew 12:38-42.
Then some of the scribes and Pharisees said to him, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." But he answered and said to them, "An evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign, and yet no sign will be given to it but the sign of Jonah the prophet. Just as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the sea monster, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will stand up with this generation at the judgment, and will condemn it because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and behold, something greater than Jonah is here."
Thank you. This, I don't think I included this in the notes either, but it also made me think about our account in Luke 16 about Abraham and the rich man, and I'll include just a portion of Luke 16:31 here, where Abraham says to the rich man, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be persuaded, even if someone rises from the dead." So, we'll wrap up in verse 13 here. "And leaving them, he again embarked and went away to the other side." The Jewish leaders had confronted him to engage in a dispute, and Jesus deliberately leaves them. A case in point example of Romans 1:24, giving them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity. The message he carried had no use here. As Matthew 7:6 says, "Do not give what is holy to dogs, and do not throw your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet." Jesus was not going to throw his pearls before these swine anymore. Following this very short trip to Galilee, Jesus and his disciples leave in their boat, and they cross back over to the Sea of Galilee, this time to Bethsaida Julius on the northeastern shore. So we have a little bit of time left here. I have a couple verses to hit to wrap up our time today. One of them is Matthew 15:14, where Jesus is speaking to the disciples about the Pharisees, and he says, "Let them alone. They are blind guides of the blind. And if a blind man guides a blind man, both will fall into a pit." And then finally, Mark 4:25, in connection to the parable of the talents, we read, "For whoever has, to him more shall be given. And whoever does not have, even what he has shall be taken away from him. At that time, I noted that those who diligently hear the truth of Jesus' teaching and apply it correctly reap the benefits and are given even more." And maybe from our example today or our time today, this Gentile crowd may certainly be an example of that. But also the flip side to that is true as well. Whoever does not have ears to hear the truth, hence not able to apply it, also reaps what they sow. So without a compass spiritually that points to Jesus, the person is not just left in neutral. They are at some point moved further away by God from the revealed truth of God Almighty. And so it's no wonder that Jesus said to his disciples in that prior verse, Mark 4:24, "Beware what you listen to." More on that next week as we continue in Mark 8. So I listed my sources there. I used D. Edmund Hebert's commentary on the Gospel of Mark, and then I have a couple of John MacArthur sermons that I used, and then also the study notes from the MacArthur Study Bible. So any questions?
Just a side issue. When you consider the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000 and the 4,000, you consider the stupendous amount of what happened here. How many loaves of bread and how many fishes were divided, which never were baked in an oven, never reaped in an harvest, never caught in the Sea of Galilee, but all having completeness, which takes you back to the creation week when God spoke. Everything he spoke had the appearance of age. I mean, you're hearing today, if you listen to nature, you're hearing today millions of years it takes for some light from a far star to hit the earth. But when God created the stars on the fourth day of creation, the light was already here. And when God created a fruit tree, it already had fruit bearing, a tree without rings. And it had full age. So all miracles of Christ were unbelievable things, and as you pointed out, and rightly so, that these people were looking for a sign. How much greater sign could you get? And your point is well taken, that they wouldn't believe if he had brought the sign.
They were they were looking for something that they just didn't have a capability to even conceive.
Yeah, it would never happen.
Yeah.
And even today, sometimes people say, if I saw a sign, I'd believe. No, you wouldn't. We walk by faith, not by signs. And they wouldn't believe a sign because it's a hard issue. So evolution is not a scientific issue. It's a spiritual issue in the fact of believing in God, Romans 1.
Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions or comments today?
Pastor, that's comment made me think of like when I studied back in Mark 5, the geography again here is really important. If you imagine the Jordan River from the Dead Sea up to the Sea of Galilee, there is a spine of mountains that follows that on its west side. And so everything on the east side, which is Decapolis and Arabia and so on and so forth, is very, very dry and very, very desolate. Even in the rainy season, it's on the leeward side.
Yep.
And so this miracle for these Gentiles are coming from a much more scattered, much more rural, much more nomadic type of people. And so to be fed in the way that they were and to be satisfied, and then to your point at the end, there was what, 7 bushels or something like that left over for them, likely was to go back to the great distances. So this miracle is really neat, and it is to, in effect, that, you know, showing to the greatest extent possible Christ's supernatural creative power.
Yeah, and really just points out to them in this real life miraculous example that Jesus is sufficient to meet all of your needs. He's sufficient to meet your physical needs and your feet, you know, keeping your body well fed, and he also is sufficient to meet all of our spiritual needs as well.
It kind of a reminder of both miracles too, that when things get short, where do you go?
Yeah.
Jesus can meet any need you and I may have, by far. We just gotta, even after 3 days of not eating, we have to have our faith in Christ. When we get to the bottom of the ladder and wonder how we're gonna make it, as you pointed out, to the point of exhaustion, that's when God provides.
Corresponding this to the spiritual now, as Rob did, Ephesians 6:7, to the praise of the glory of his grace, which he freely bestowed on us in the beloved. In him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of our sins, according to the riches of his grace, which he lavished on us in all wisdom and insight. So they had more bread than they knew what to do with. We have more grace than we know what to do with.
Right. Yeah. That's the truth. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Appreciate that. Appreciate your time. Yeah, thanks, John.